It's hardcore history.
Addendum.
So the conversation that you're about to listen to was done through a format that I ripped off from the people that we're talking with, because I was on their podcast not that long ago, and I remember thinking that the way that they put it together structurally was fantastic for three people, because when you have three people in a conversation, it can get unwieldy sometimes. I thought they did a great job. The show, I thought, went fantastic, and in fact, I liked it so much that I thought I'd like to do a version of sort of a part two, if you will, on our own podcast. So perhaps it's fair to say part one is available from the archives of the Rest is History podcast. And, well, this is part two. The guest on the program, the hosts of that podcast, Dominic Sandbrook and Tom Holland, both writers, TV presenters, radio hosts. I mean, they have very varied careers. And while Dominic's point of emphasis is usually more in the 1970s, 1980s, sometimes Churchill stuff, Tom Holland rolls around in the mud that we like to roll around in often, and I've used his books for research materials. I think we used Persian Fire for the Persian shows. We definitely used his book on the fall of the Roman Republic, Rubicon, for our Fall of the Roman Republic series, and he's got a recent workout on the impact of, I guess you could say, Christian thinking on Western society called Dominion, all of it worth your time. And as a podcast, The Rest is History is absolutely worth your time. And if you go, if you haven't already, and delve into their archives, tons of fun stuff on offering. So check that out if you like what you're about to hear. If you like what you're about to hear, remember, it's kind of part two of an ongoing conversation. Check out part one on their podcast when you have a chance. And without further ado, let's just call this part two. All right, gentlemen, I'm considering this part two of the earlier discussion that we had on your program, and so I'm going to throw some questions out there, and you feel free to take them in any direction you want. But since I have two Brits with me, when my mom was working in London when I was a kid, I was about 5 or 6 years old, and I was completely enamored with King Arthur at the time. And yet, even at 5 or 6, I could tell that there was a bunch of nonsense involved in the story. But I was under the impression that you could just stop passersby on the street in London and ask them for the true story. And as you can imagine, I still am unsatisfied with the answers I got. So I thought I would tap into the brain trust here and ask you guys your opinion, and it may differ from each other. Do you think that the King Arthur legend is rooted in any sort of reality, or is this a fabricated myth from the get-go?
Tom, do you want to go first? And your views on this?
Well, I don't think that Arthur, a historical Arthur, existed, is the kind of blunt and brutal truth. And it saddens me to say that, because I would always rather that there was some kind of root of reality at the base of a myth. But having said that, I think that the way that the story has evolved, it's had different kind of resonances in different periods of time. And so in that sense, tracing where the story comes from actually tells you quite a lot about medieval history, early medieval history, the beginnings of Britain, the beginnings of England, the forging of medieval culture. So in that sense, I think Arthur is a really fascinating topic of historical inquiry. But I think that kind of burrowing around, assuming that there is some real Arthur at the base of it, I think that that's a fantasy.
Yeah, I agree with Tom, Dan. I think I don't think there was anybody called Arthur, and I don't think any historian or archaeologist or, you know, ethnographer or whatever will ever uncover a single individual who's at the heart of the legend. But I completely agree with Tom that the legend itself is clearly, I mean, it's like all legends, it's rooted in something. I mean, it wasn't invented as a fiction. So it clearly draws on folk memories, on myths, on, you know, it tells you an enormous amount, not so much maybe about what we now call England in the Dark Ages, I would say, but the way that later generations thought of that period and the way they thought of themselves. And, you know, I guess the myth is more interesting than the man now, isn't it? I mean, if there were a figure like Arthur, he must have been a what would you say, Tom, a kind of Romano-British warlord or something? I mean, ultimately, how interesting is that compared with the legend of Arthur and the way that's accumulated over time? Don't you think?
What do you think, Dan?
Well, I'm riffing off what you guys just said, because if this is a part of Englishness, if we could call it that, then how do we?
Well, but Dan, actually, that's like one of the things that's fascinating about it, is that it's not about Englishness so much, although it becomes that, because of course the English are the enemies.
Right. I was just going to say that was exactly the invaders. That's exactly where I was going. If this is a guy fighting the Anglo-Saxons, which are a key component of the blending that will eventually happen, how is this guy anything other than some sort of Romano-Celtic hero or something like that? In other words, how did he get wrapped up into sort of English history when, like you said, here he is fighting the Saxon invaders who are going to fuse with the various kingdoms to create what we think of as England, correct?
Well, there are all these kind of these traditions that are floating around, but the guy who really compiles them is a bloke called Geoffrey of Monmouth,
right,
who is writing as a Welshman, essentially. And his book is... Arthur is a key figure, but not the only one. And it's a story about how Britain is founded by Brutus, who is a refugee Trojan who comes to Britain and fights various giants. And that's very much the level at which this is operating.
And you're saying that that's not historical, is what I'm
getting
from. Okay, just alas, double checking.
Alas, okay. Alas, alas.
England is still a nation of giants, Dan.
That's what I've heard from every Englishman,
but
yes.
Geoffrey is... basically casting the English, the Sassenachs, the Saxons, as the enemy. But of course, by this point, you have Norman kings of England descended from the from William the Conqueror, and they end up conquering Wales. So the kings of England. And so those Welsh traditions get absorbed into they become the matter of Britain, and the kings of England see themselves as the rulers of the whole of Britain. So just as they absorb the mountains and the valleys of Wales into their kingdom, so also do they end up absorbing these traditions about King Arthur. And that's why you have Edward the First, who is the king who conquers Wales. He's obsessed by Arthur. I mean, he's the guy who goes to Glastonbury and claims to
and digs up the tomb that supposedly has the and the monks were maybe involved in that for a little bit of, you know, Glastonbury publicity and whatnot.
And then, of course, it works. There are further twists, aren't there? Because at the beginning of the 16th century, I guess, when you have the advent of the Tudors. So obviously Henry Tudor landing in 1485, beating Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth. The idea of the Tudors as the heirs to Arthur is really important to them. So Henry VII's son, who famously, you know, dies at Ludlow Castle, paving the way for Henry VIII to become king, he's called Arthur. Henry VIII loves the story of King Arthur. I mean, am I not right in thinking, Tom, that Henry VIII repairs the great painting of the Round Table and has it done for the visit of the emperor? For the visit?
Yes, he does. And one of the things that's also As Dominic says, it has political capital, because in a way, Arthur is a very, very famous English export, at a time when England is really quite a peripheral kingdom to the rest of Europe. Arthur is a name that matters. The matter of Britain is something that resonates through all the courts of Europe. So the upstart Tudors, by laying claim to that, are... you know, they're aggrandizing their own dynasty and they're aggrandizing their kingdom. But I think also the way that Henry VIII repairs this supposed round table that's hanging in Winchester shows the way in which it's not just us who are romanticizing these stories. People were doing it in the Middle Ages. And so my favorite example of that is Tintagel, this incredibly romantic castle in Cornwall. I mean, it's kind of one of the jewels in the Cornish tourist industry. And it's a jewel because it looks exactly what you would imagine King Arthur's birthplace would look like. It's on a kind of rocky island. The waves are crashing into the rocks. There are kind of beautiful bridges that span it. It looks like something from a medieval romance. And the reason for that is that that's what it was designed to look like. It was built by the brother of Henry III, who's Edward I's son, Richard, Duke of Cornwall. And he builds it to look like King Arthur's castle. So even then, they're kind of constructing and fashioning the myth. And now, of course, when tourists go to Tintagel, they're buying into a medieval idea of what a medieval castle looked like. So there are just kind of, you know, reflection after reflection after reflection, all these kind of mirrors held up to each other, which is what makes it such a brilliant, brilliant story.
Yeah. And I think one other element, obviously, is that in 1707, England and Scotland officially become Great Britain, the Kingdom of Great Britain. And at that point, I think Arthur does become, he's both a British hero and an English one, because England and Britain, certainly in the minds of the English, become acquainted with each other. So one of the most famous books ever written about British history, or indeed English history, which most of your listeners, I'm guessing, will seem like gibberish to them, is the book called 1066 and All That, a comic book by Sellers and Yeatman at the beginning of the 20th century. And one of the jokes in that book, so it's basically a parody of the history that kids were taught in, I guess, would you say Edwardian schools, Tom, early 20th century schools? And one of the jokes in it is that the book constantly mixes up King Arthur and Alfred the Great. But I think that's what even now lots of people kind of mix the two of them, don't they, Tom?
Yeah.
They have a sort of sense that they fought invaders, they did stuff with candles and timekeeping, they were good Christian kings, all this kind of stuff.
Well, I think actually, I mean, I think that's, it's intriguing that they make that joke, because I think actually one of the models for Geoffrey of Monmouth's portrayal of Arthur is Alfred's grandson, Athelstan, who is the English king who essentially creates the Kingdom of England and is the first really to make the Princess of Wales pay the English crown tribute. And the his history of Britain ends with the coming to power of Athelstan. It's as though this is where British history stops, because the English have completely taken over. And actually, the portrayal of Arthur in Geoffrey of Monmouth's history, it has lots of echoes of Athelstan. So it's kind of like Geoffrey is trying to supply a British mirror image of Athelstan.
So the short answer to your question, Dan, is
it's complicated. I remember buying books in London as a kid, Arthur's In Search of Arthur's Britain, all these kind of things where it seemed as though the British themselves were trying to get a handle on what this was. And I remember that the book was very unsatisfying, because instead of giving me a yes or no answer, it sort of just took you through the post-Romano-British, you know, myths and countryside and all that. But you folks mentioned the Normans a minute ago, so let me bring you into something that I said recently, and let me get your opinion on it. So I've always been fascinated with the fact that, you know, nowadays, if you try to fight a modern army against an army from 30 years ago, it's ridiculous. But for most of human history, with technology moving either as slowly as it did, or with these sort of, let's call it, ebbs and flows of capabilities, right? So someone from an earlier era could have a military that was more capable from someone perhaps in a later era, which is, of course, anathema now. I had said that I thought that Julius Caesar's Romans would have defeated William the Conqueror's Normans, and of course there's, you know, centuries and centuries and centuries between the two, took some flack for that. Do you folks have an opinion on that?
I have an opinion on that. I would say Caesar would undoubtedly be in the Normans. Undoubtedly. So the Normans, I guess their big innovation, Tom knows more about this than I do, so once I've spoken, Tom will tell me where I've gone wrong.
You're absolutely bang on the money.
Their big innovation is knights, isn't it? Mounted cavalry. Basically, sort of armored cavalry, I guess you would say.
Yeah, and lances. The ability to use a lance in a
big spears. Alexander the Great had big spears, Tom, as we've discussed on our own podcast many times. So I would say that the Romans would have won because they had infinitely superior logistics. They gave much more thought to military strategy. They had a more resilient political structure behind them. You know, they had these incredibly well-trained, well-disciplined, professional troops. And what are the Normans? I mean, the Normans are, if you were being harsh about the Normans, you would say they're a war band. You know, they're just slightly superior Vikings, aren't they, Tom? Vikings.
I think that Norman cavalry is incredibly proficient. And as a kind of, you know, a Norman boy, you're trained to the saddle and you are raised to handle a lance from the saddle, because it's a very, very difficult thing to do, apparently. I've never tried it, but it doesn't come easily. So they are very, very formidable cavalry, but I agree with Dominic and I completely agree with you, Dan. I think Caesar's legions would have wiped the floor with the Normans, because they were the most lethal fighting force that the world up to that point had seen. And in due course, they were to become even more lethal. because they would become these kind of professional armies. And I think that the only way to defeat that class of infantry was the way that the Parthians did against Crassus's army in the desert, which is to have kind of vast, open, blank expanse of land and have very, very mobile horse archers. But I think otherwise, the Romans are always going to defeat the Normans, not least because, of course, infantry against cavalry, that's what you get at Hastings. That's the kind of, you know, the elephant against the whale kind of situation. But Caesar had great cavalry. I mean, Caesar recruited Gallic cavalry. He recruited archers. He had all kinds of auxiliaries who would have been part of the mix as well. And as a Roman commander, he would have been perfectly happy to sacrifice them. Whereas the Romans probably...
Tom, don't the Romans have much larger numbers anyway?
Because of the logistics, they can support greater numbers.
Military machine is far greater. And also, you mentioned Hastings. Yeah. I mean, the Normans, they don't almost lose with the Saxons. Yeah, they almost lose at Hastings.
And the Anglo-Saxon heavy infantry was reputedly the best in Europe, which is why after Hastings, so many of them go to Constantinople and serve as the bodyguards.
Yeah, the Varangians, the emperor. Right.
Yeah. But even so, I mean, the Anglo-Saxon military cannot compare for professionalism or training or discipline to the Romans.
Well, and that army had just come from fighting in the north too. It wasn't even the best example of an Anglo-Saxon army, was it?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think if it's a close run thing at Hastings against Harold's army, I think they would have been annihilated by Caesar's army.
And that is centuries and centuries beforehand. So what do you think accounts for that? And what makes it so? Because I'm fascinated with the fact that the dynamic is so different today than it was throughout military history, right? Where our armies from centuries previously could have, I mean, Alexander's army would have given, I would say, many of the later armies a go. There was a book by Arthur Farrell. I've forgotten the title at hand, but at the very end of it, he tried to imagine Napoleon trying to fight Alexander. And he said, if you could discount the effect of firearms on a morale level, that even might be a near run thing. What do you folks think about taking it that far into the recent past?
Well, it's technology, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, it's technology that makes the difference. So the evolution, you know, the discovery of iron, say, as opposed to bronze, an Iron Age army is going to defeat a Bronze Age army
because of the difference in the metals.
Yes, because the effect of an iron sword is going to be, you know, lethal on a bronze sword, for instance. And likewise, the development, say, of the stirrup facilitates a quality of cavalry that you wouldn't have before that. And obviously, the development of gunpowder completely changes the equation. But if you are measuring, say, a Roman legion against any kind of army that is pre-gunpowder, say from the first or second centuries AD, when they're at their most professional, I think that they are likely to win simply because they have the mass infrastructure of this vast empire behind them. And that empire, essentially, that empire is conquered by the legions, but it comes to exist purely to keep the legions going. So you could describe the Roman Empire almost as a series of military bases, with a tax base attached. That's essentially how the Roman Empire functions. And when you have that amount of money, that amount of professionalism, basically anyone that you meet is likely to be defeated. And even when, the Roman armies do lose, they do get defeated, they always come back. It's an absolute premise of Roman military doctrine that the Romans never lose. So even if the Germans wipe out some armies or the Judeans wipe out some armies, the Romans will come back and they will inflict devastating punishment. And nobody basically can withstand them. And that includes the Parthians. you know, apart from Carrhae, basically the Romans can always have, the Romans know that they always have the beating of the Parthians.
Well, so that's me.
Couldn't one make the case though that Carrhae was bad generalship too? I mean, there was some, yeah. Okay.
You could.
Sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Dominic.
Yeah.
No, go ahead. I was going to say that what Tom was saying, I completely agree with Tom's point. And I think military success is often a question of technology and political organization. And I think we tend to, because we emphasize so often generals and battles, we lose sight of the fact that, I mean, Tom said infrastructure, and I think infrastructure is absolutely key. There's a brilliant book about the Second World War by a guy, an American who's based in Britain, called Phillips Payson O'Brien. And he basically argues that in the Second World War, that all the battles are completely irrelevant. And if you tell the story talking about the battles, you're missing, you know, why the Allies won, which is all about logistics and infrastructure. And I think, you know, anybody, tons of your listeners, I imagine, will have played computer strategy games where, you know, yes. You know that if you've got, if the spreadsheet is working and you've got all your resources and you've got your logistics all sorted out, then in a way it doesn't matter if you lose a couple of battles because you can, you know, you can recover from that. And I think actually the Roman political organization, let's say, was so robust, so resilient, so effective, so efficient that it was just infinitely better, wasn't it, Tom, than the organization of kind of Western European medieval kingdoms. Much more sophisticated, much more reliable tax base, you know, sort of it's seasoned. It's
professionalism. It's,
yeah, pure professionalism.
And
it's not some bloke who's a nobleman who spends his time kind of, you know, molesting the daughters of the local peasants. And then once every now and again, it's called on to fight the French or the English or whoever it might be. Of course, he spent all his time in the saddle and all that. But that's not the same as somebody who spent his life in Roman military bases, as Tom says, you know, trudging up and down the roads, practicing, training, being drilled. You know, I think there's...
And being forged, and it's the drill as well.
For
it's
sure.
The being forged into a single unit. And that's why really, you know, it's only when states in Europe are able to raise sufficient taxes again to keep professional armies and therefore to have them drilled and to operate as entities that you start to get anything approximating to the professionals.
Exactly. And that's why, you don't get the drill and all that stuff without the political organization. And so what I would say, I'm sure Tom would agree, is that the Roman Empire at its height, or the Roman system at its height, represents a kind of apogee of organization. And then there's a long period of fragmentation. And then I guess, what would you say, Tom, the early modern period, you get organized European states organizing, raising taxes at a level comparable to that. So that's why Napoleon, for example, who was able to draw on the power of nationalism in a way that people hadn't really done so powerfully before that. That's why Napoleon undoubtedly would have given the Romans a good run for their money in a way that I don't think, you know, Oliver Cromwell's army. As excited as they would have been about reading their Bibles, and you know, I don't think they would have.
But I think also talking about Napoleon, and also thinking about the armies in the American Civil War, the idea of citizen armies, that's also a crucial part of the way that legions are organized. So a legion was literally a levy. It's the Roman people in arms, and in time as you know, the empire gets larger and larger and you need more and more legiones, more and more legions. That sense slightly starts to diminish. But say in the first century AD, the Roman Republic has collapsed. But if you want a microcosm of Rome as it was in the Republic, this idea of a kind of a body of men who are, their strength lies in their coherence, in their discipline, in their sense of comradeship, you would go to a legionary base to find that. You wouldn't go to Rome. And that sense of a kind of a martial civic identity is what the French Revolutionary Army, Napoleonic armies, the armies in the American Civil War, and then the citizen armies in the First World War. That's what makes them, it's also a crucial part of what makes them so lethal.
Well, it's interesting because you would think that if the Romans were beating you all the time, that you would simply try to copy what they did, right? We all know that phalanxes spread across the ancient world once that became a popular way of war.
And we know that there were things like imitation legionaries that were created once the Romans started to show that the Roman way of war was so dominant, but it never quite lived up to the original. And it reminded me of, for example, the early history of modern battleships, where certain countries could produce battleships and other countries would buy battleships from countries who could make them because this was going to be the equivalent of their Roman legionaries. If you didn't have battleships, you couldn't compete. And yet the states that couldn't build their own never quite seemed to rise to the level of the states that could. Why do you think that certain kinds of military technologies are transferable and other kinds of military technologies aren't? Is it because they're wedded to the society or the system? Or, I mean, somebody like Victor Davis Hanson back in the day would have said it's a cultural question, you know, the Western way of war and all this. Any thoughts on why certain kinds of military technology aren't? Barbed wire's transferable. Roman legionary seems to not be. Steppe cavalry, you know, Mongol, Hun, Scythian cavalry, not really transferable. Any thoughts on that?
Well, surely the answer to that is that barbed wire is transferable because barbed wire is just a very simple, you know, it's just a very simple thing. It's a device. Whereas a Roman legionary is a political and cultural construct. And you can't just, it's a bit like, I would say, trying to copy a Roman legionary or indeed a kind of, let's say, an early 20th century dreadnought or something. It's a bit like thinking you can transplant it from one society to another is like thinking you can just pitch up in any given part of the world and implant the, you know, Western-style democracy or something. Because these things are not, they're not sort of, I would say, they're not accessories that you pick up at the shopping mall. They are an expression, a reflection of a political and cultural sort of a landscape. So in that sense, I would completely agree with Victor. Victor Davis Hanson.
Yeah,
I would completely agree with that. I think there was a Western way of war that's obviously rooted in Western, you know, let's say by the 20th century, Western democratic industrial civilization. You can't just transplant something as complicated as a battleship or indeed a legionary from one setting to another. Whereas barbed wire, which is relatively simple, you can. What do you think, Tom?
I completely agree. I mean, if you're a technologically advanced civilization, then you're going to have more lethal weaponry. I mean, it's that's always the way. I mean, you talked about computer games. If you play something like Civilization, where you start off with a band of hunter-gatherers and then you end up flying to Alpha Centauri, that you know that going to war with a phalanx against a squadron of tanks, you're absolutely going to be flattened. And I think that we can see that actually playing out in front of our eyes at the moment in Ukraine, where the Russian armed forces had the kit, but because a lot of that kit derived from Western sources, now that they are subject to sanctions, their ability to source that kit is diminishing. And the more it diminishes, so they have to kind of start shopping around in Tehran or wherever to try and find the drones or whatever that they need. And you realize the degree to which military proficiency is a reflection of industrial proficiency, technological proficiency. And that's why the West has always been ahead of the game for so long, is that, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, at least, maybe before that, it's always been at the cutting edge. And perhaps, you know, one of the unsettling things if you're in the West at the moment is the notion that perhaps that age is fading, not with Russia, but with China.
Okay, you guys bring up now first tangent of the program here, because you bring up something that I find fascinating. I remember, as a kid, we were wargaming, and we would talk about the 1973 conflicts in the Middle East and this idea at the time, and you folks have certainly studied this, that the handheld weapons of infantry were going to make tanks obsolete, and that you could already see that being foreshadowed in the 73 war. Well, of course, you know, tanks sort of made a comeback, and the long struggle between offense and defense that you can see going back to armor and all those kinds of things in the Middle Ages came into play, and tanks sort of got a second lease on life. If you guys had to guess, are we seeing the predictions of 73 finally coming true now with Ukraine and drones and better handheld weapons that are anti-tank weapons? Or is this going to be another case of a premature writing off of armor?
I've seen a lot of stuff on debate, actually, on social media about this, Dan. The arguments that I think there were a lot of people who were overpraising the Russians before the war started, who were great enthusiasts for tanks and said, oh, the Russians are, you know, their brute force is unparalleled and all this sort of thing. And then there was all this sort of amateur footage of Ukrainians with kind of, yeah. you know, amateur sort of stuff they'd built in their kitchen, taking out a tank yeah. or whatever.
Hauling them off with tractors.
Right, exactly. So I don't know. I mean, the death of the tank has been predicted many times, hasn't it, since the invention of the tank. In fact, there were tank skeptics even when the tank was invented. I would guess that tanks, I mean, it feels to me such a 20th century weapon of warfare. And I would guess that in a world of drones and of handheld, you know, anti-tank sort of launchers or whatever, I would guess that in 2050, will tanks play such a part as they do now? I would think not.
I don't know. And I don't envy defense secretaries at the moment having to decide how they slice and dice their defense budgets, kind of knowing that a wrong punt and you might be stuck with completely obsolete equipment.
Well, that brings
up. If you were the Pentagon, Tom, you wouldn't invest in tanks, would you? If you were the
Yeah, but if I'm the Pentagon, I can afford to, you know,
waste a lot of money.
Can't I?
Right, yeah. You can hedge your bets. Yeah. We have plenty of tanks. Yeah, but that then brings the question from the land warfare element to the naval warfare element. Could one say the same about surface vessels? I mean, we're talking about big, slow, large targets.
Well,
what do you think about that?
Well, I guess we'll have to wait for the Chinese to invade.
I know
Taiwan.
The Straits of Taiwan looms, doesn't it?
To find
we in Britain are the worst people to ask, because we're of course completely, because we still have the very strongly the romance of the Royal Navy. So in the 1980s, which is really my period, Britain was very close to basically scrapping most of the Royal Navy, and then the Falklands War happened, and we ended up keeping far more of it than we'd planned to. And now we're sort of slightly, I mean, if people from the Royal Navy listen to this, they'll be appalled to hear this, but we're kind of stuck with it. And it's a bit of an albatross because we're very unlikely to use it in any meaningful way.
So we've got two huge aircraft carriers that I don't think we can actually afford to send to sea because we don't have the necessary flotilla that would guard these aircraft carriers from being attacked by kind of underwater missiles or whatever. However, we have two aircraft carriers. The French have one.
Yeah. It's very important that we shouldn't be overtaken by the French.
Essentially, that is justification enough.
Yeah. Well, but you guys bring up now an interesting point, and I think it applies to the tank question, too. So if I say to American military people that the tanks are obsolete and you can see that this lesson's being taught in Ukraine, et cetera, and one can make the same thing maybe about surface vessels on the high seas, they will counter with the line that this is a system, not a weapon, and that the system requires things like infantry that would fan out, you know, on either side of the armored columns to prevent people from being able to get close enough to use handheld weapons. They would say that in order to prevent, for example, your aircraft carriers being destroyed by, you know, surface-to-surface anti-ship missiles, that there's an entire system involved. You have, you know, picket ships and everything else. Could one make the case that some of this is poor handling of the entire system rather than criticism of an individual weapon?
Well, Dan, I don't in any way want to imply that I am in any way a military expert. And
That's how we're treating you. Probably that's how you're going to be. No, we're
Tom,
advertising
you
as that. Yes,
but when it comes to the United States, it does seem that there is a problem, which is that essentially the US is preparing for two kinds of war. The first is the war kind of war that they've been fighting over the past 30 years. So the 9/11 wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, whatever, where all kinds of the amazing kit that you've got is essentially useless because the people that you're fighting, the enemy, it's all so asymmetrical that in a way you have to invest all your money in intelligence and counterinsurgency and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I suppose it's the lesson of Vietnam. The other is, of course, that the US is preparing for a superpower conflict, first with the Soviet Union and now, I suppose, with China. And again, the prospect of that is so horrendous that, you know, the exchange of a few nuclear missiles would, again, render all the tanks and the aircraft carriers and so on useless. Nevertheless, the US is the number one superpower. And it's a number one superpower because it has the most proficient military. So in a way, it's a kind of badge of superpower status. But it seems to me a badge that you can never really use. I mean, you can never bring to bear with the full intensity, perhaps, that, you know, in a kind of a dream campaign you would, because you're never going to be fighting those kind of campaigns.
You don't see vast tank armies clashing in the plains of China, Tom?
I don't.
No, it's very implausible. No, I don't at all. When are they going to use all these tanks?
And you know, and there was a kind of brief upsurge of dread, I suppose, that maybe this is what we faced in Europe, that Russian tanks would drive across the Ukrainian plain and then perhaps into Poland, or, you know, and who knows where they might stop. But I think that prospect now is looking fairly improbable as well.
Well, which brings us to one of the reasons that it's fairly improbable, and I would say nuclear weapons come into play. And I've been having discussions with people about this lately, and I find it appalling the willingness. You know, when we were all we're all from a generation where thinking about nuclear weapons was something that was on our mind immensely more often and more deeply than it's on anyone's mind. Well, maybe it's changed in the past year, but 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I would find an appalling lack of, let's call it respect, maybe, for what these weapons can do. I had written this down to potentially talk about, but if we could imagine what a nuclear bomb or missile being used today, filmed with iPhones, you know, from on the ground in full living color with sound, what this really meant, I feel like it might be the kind of thing where you would fully understand. I mean, let's put it this way. Had we never used nuclear weapons in the Second World War, atomic bomb doesn't get dropped on Hiroshima, and we have nuclear weapons, but we've never seen what they had done, I would imagine it would be much more likely that they would be used. Had nuclear weapons been used after the Second World War, maybe let's just say 20 years afterwards, do you think that would be something that would prevent or inhibit their use more? This is a weird way to phrase this question. I'm trying to figure out maybe the value of having an object lesson versus the theoretical idea of, oh, we have these terrible weapons and they'll do terrible things, but you can't even imagine what that might mean. There's a wonderful, and I'm sure you guys have seen something like this, there's a wonderful thing online where you can see how far the blast radius of a big nuclear weapon, I think it's Paris or something that they use, or maybe you could choose the city, and you can see exactly how far the damage is. Do you think when we're talking about unimaginable weapons like this, that they almost lose their ability to deter because we can't even imagine what we're talking about here?
So Dan, are you basically implying that Hiroshima and Nagasaki are too far distant to serve as object lessons now?
Here's what I would suggest. I would suggest that if you look, and I know you guys have probably done this too, if you look at the example, there are so few, I mean, you know, as a former television news reporter, they used to teach you the value of pictures and sound and stuff like that. To have black and white photos or the tiny little things that we have, imagine if we had iPhones at Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the different levels of intensity that something like that would have on our collective psyche versus, and also, let's be honest, if you're a Second World War aficionado, it sounds so strange to say you're a Second World War buff or something, but I mean, there is so much violence and so much disaster from the strategic bombing campaigns and everything else that it all sort of blends together. But had there been a nuclear weapon used in 1958, for example, with color photos, and I feel like the object, I mean, it's almost like a generation has to almost learn these things over and over, or we forget them. I don't know that there's a question there, gentlemen, but maybe pick up from where I left off.
I think there are actually two different issues there. So one is our fear of nuclear weapons, but the other one, which I don't think is the question you're asking, but I think is just as interesting, actually, is about the way in which as a society we regard moving color images as so close to us. So we say, look at the Beatles in the Peter Jackson documentary. They look just like us.
Yes, they do.
You know. And then we look at people from the Second World War and we say, you know, they look ridiculous. They're wearing old-fashioned clothes. They're moving jerkily in the black and white footage and so on. And I do think you're absolutely right that black and white footage and black and white still pictures act as a kind of barrier to our empathy, maybe, because we just think old people from history, so they don't kind of count in the same way that, that people do now. Having said that, to return to your real point, I think in a way your question is too kind to human nature, because you're basically saying if we had incredibly picture perfect imagery of, you know, the effects of a nuclear bomb, we would learn, we would be chastened, we'd be horrified, and we would, you know, mend our ways in some way. But, you know, we had you know, color imagery of the effects of bombing in Vietnam, let's say, or so many wars since then, so many atrocities, and human beings haven't changed. People have carried on fighting wars and disgracing themselves in various ways. So I don't actually think, even if it was in color, even if it was so vivid and palpable, I don't think we would change.
I mean, I think that, say, I don't know, America and China and Russia each had 10 nuclear missiles. The likelihood is that they would use them, because it wouldn't mean the end of them as countries, and it wouldn't mean the end of human civilization. The reason that we were all terrified of nuclear war and we lived in its shadow was that it wasn't because we'd seen the horror inflicted on Hiroshima. I mean, just as much horror was inflicted on Dresden or Hamburg or Tokyo or whatever. It was the knowledge that human civilization would be destroyed and perhaps life on Earth would be destroyed. And that hardcore of scientific knowledge was then played upon by filmmakers and science fiction writers in ways that, because it was rooted in reality, certainly gave me nightmares, and I think gave an entire generation nightmares. So you had The Day After in the United States. Yes. We had a series in Britain called Threads. And the impact of this was terrifying. And I remember a science film of exactly the kind that you were describing that was themed around what would happen if a nuclear bomb went off over St. Paul's. And I must have been about 10 when this went out. And I still remember that they wanted to show what the impact of flying glass would be. And they put a pumpkin on a stick and then sent the flying glass, and the pumpkin was completely lacerated. Couldn't sleep after that for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then at the end of Threads, which tells a story of a nuclear war that destroys Britain, it showed the heroine, the woman who we'd been following. She gets raped and she gives birth to a child, and the last still is her looking down to see what she's born, and she's screaming with horror. And that was the thing, note that the film ended on. That absolutely stays with me, and it means that the very notion of nuclear war is a shadow that hangs over me to this day. I think that the interesting contrast is, say, with global warming or climate change, which is often described as the equivalent challenge facing people the generations younger than ours. The problem with that is, firstly, that the science is less absolutely grounded, and secondly, that you can't sum it up with a kind of image of, you know, a pumpkin being smashed to pieces by glass, or a pregnant woman looking down and seeing that she's given birth to some monstrosity. It doesn't lend itself to images of that horror, even though in the long run, I don't know, I'm not a climate scientist, the results may be analogous. So I think that when you said that we need to kind of re-educate ourselves about nuclear weapons, I think you're right, because essentially for what, 30 years now, the world has been able to assume that it won't happen. And part of what happened with Ukraine, and part of what is a kind of, you know, it's like the first onset of a migraine with Taiwan, is the possibility that we might be plunged back into the kind of scenarios that gave rise to those terrifying films in which the world is destroyed.
Isn't it interesting, though, Tom, that those films, I mean, they're about us as the victims, right? And I think what held the world back, so I think that's an excellent point about if they'd only had a few nuclear weapons, they'd have used them. And I think the reason is because what deterred nuclear war was not the fear of inflicting terrible, you know, atrocities and damage, but it was the fear of incurring
what happened
them.
To us.
Yeah, what happened to us. It wasn't, if I would say human history shows that if people are presented with an opportunity to inflict a horrendous horror on their competitors, they will, by and large, take it. It's the fear of incurring that that held the superpowers back in the Cold War.
Let me throw an angle in there too that makes it, if not unique, then very unusual in military history. You don't have to be a belligerent to be a victim in the nuclear conflict, right? In other words, if you're India and you're going to be, you're not going to be involved in this war, for example, it doesn't matter. In a full-on nuclear exchange, people in India are going to suffer also. That's, it's almost like all of a sudden real war, total war, as we used to call it, is something that involves everyone now. And so I mean, it's a fascinating way of looking at something that's been a human construct since civilization first arose, right? I'm going to fight you. But now if I fight you, maybe you could say that the person right over the border is going to be affected because, you know, refugees might stream over the border. But now this is you're going to be involving everyone in your personal sort of conflict in a way that, I mean, there is no neutrals, right? I remember reading about years ago, but I mean, the polluted milk in Scandinavia from radiation. That, I mean, you start to realize, okay, all of a sudden, if we want to use all the weapons that are in our arsenal, it's going to involve people that are not part of the conflict at all. What did Bertrand Russell say? He talked about that it was unreasonable for man to expect to walk a tightrope. You could walk a tightrope for a certain period of time, but it was unreasonable to expect you to be able to do it forever. And I feel like, to piggyback up on what Tom had said, we've almost forgotten that we're walking on that tightrope. And it takes something like a Ukraine and nuclear powers being angry with each other to potentially remind us that we're still on that tightrope and it's just as dangerous as it's always been, if not more.
Well, I mean, I think that obviously having your city pulverized is an utter horror. But a deeper horror is to imagine that it's permanently poisoned. So that's what you have with Chernobyl. You see, it's happened, you know, decades and decades ago, but people are going in there now in the war, and they're dying from going there. And the idea that the whole world would be poisoned in that way, I think, adds an extra dimension of terror. And then in the 80s, scientists, both in the Soviet Union and in the West, combined on a paper to argue of what was called a nuclear winter, the idea that so much debris would be thrown up that the sun would be blotted out. And therefore, even if radioactivity weren't completely lethal to life on Earth, the sunlight would go, and without sun, crops would die and people would starve to death, and the whole world would starve to death. And I remember that the scientists that presented that paper, they chose a poem by Byron and a translation of it by Pushkin to put at the head of the paper. And Byron's poem, he wrote it in 1816, which was the year without a summer, the same year that gave rise to Frankenstein, the story of Mary Shelley's novel Frankenstein.
There's a big volcano in that year, right?
That's right. Well, it was the year before, I think, and it kind of spewed it up, and so the sun was blotted out. And actually, it was the last time of mass famine in Europe. But in Byron's image, everything just goes dark. And the theme of it is that no one is responsible. No one's to blame for it. It's just a curse that happens. And the last thing is two people discover some wood, they set light to it, they realize they hate each other, they kill each other. And that's the cheery note on which it ends.
One thing we do know, interestingly though, is that these kind of things did have an effect on policymakers. So we know, for example, that Ronald Reagan was really interested in things like the day after. He was strongly affected by them. He was personally had a horror of nuclear weapons. I mean, the irony is that all the time, you know, his critics were sort of calling him a gun-toting cowboy and stuff, who was poised to start World War III. But we know now that Reagan read a lot of this stuff, that he was really interested in the day after, and profoundly affected by all of this. So a responsible... Yeah, these, I guess that bears out your point, Dan, that these reminders, if you like, whether they be scientific reminders or fictional, kind of science fictional reminders, they mattered during the Cold War, and they helped to instill, I guess you would say, a kind of responsibility and restraint.
Let me explain for people who maybe don't know what we're talking about. We're old enough to remember that The Day After was a movie, right? The Day After, at middle 1980s, it came out, and The Day After was a dramatization of what would happen in a nuclear war. And the story is, and I'm not sure it's true, but I've read it in several different memoirs,
was that Ronald Reagan used to have movies screened in the White House, and they screened this movie for him, and he was profoundly affected by it in a way. Look, this is a man who had studied, you know, I mean, he should have understood without having to see the movie, but the movie made all the difference. And it, and supposedly the story is that this led to him taking Mikhail Gorbachev aside for a private conversation during a summit, which led to all, I mean, one could argue that there were a lot of dominoes starting to tumble right then that created a lot of the world we live in right now. And wouldn't that be amazing if you were the filmmaker that made The Day After, if you could somehow tie your artistic decisions into something as monumental as that?
And there's another element to that, which is that some of your listeners may know about the Abel Archer.
Oh, yes. The near miss.
The near miss. So when, so this is a, there was a NATO war game. I think it was in the Low Countries. And the Kremlin were very worried that this was actually the prelude to war, because their own war games envisaged that NATO would strike during a war game. So they, you know, they got in a terrible sort of state about it. I think it's Oleg Gordievsky, the
man who saved the world, right?
Right. Who passes the story to his British handlers, and it finds its way to the White House. And when Reagan heard this, he was really struck and astonished, because of course up to that point Reagan had thought of the Soviet Union as the evil empire. And he'd thought, you know, these guys are the villains. They're out to kind of, you know, they're part of the great conspiracy of international communism. And for the you know, he sort of, I think he writes it in his diary or in his journal or something. For the first time, he thinks they're just frightened old men, and they, and he's stunned by the idea that they think the West would strike them first. And I think it's such an interesting. You know, he had, it had never occurred to him before that, that the Russians were as frightened of being nuked by him as he was by them.
Because to be afraid of nuclear war, you've got to think that someone who has his finger on the nuclear button would press it. And that requires you to think quite dark thoughts about people who may be your enemies. And I think that people both in the West and in the Soviet Union did think that about their adversaries. And, you know, as Dominic says, that is was a crucial part in opening Reagan to the notion that perhaps the evil empire wasn't so evil. But I also think that that is one of the reasons why people are so unsettled by what's happening in Ukraine now, is that Putin has the look of Dr. Evil about him. And he has the kind of sheen of, a supervillain in the kind of film where the villain is threatening the world with nuclear blackmail. And the fact that, you know, Russian propaganda has made play with that, has kind of hinted at devastating responses, kind of breaks a taboo, because actually, even, you know, the idea that you would threaten first use was something that both sides, I think, is that right, Dominic, avoided during the
Cold War?
Either side was doing that. Of course, I mean, it's a slight difference, isn't there? Because Putin presumably is talking about tactical battlefield nuclear weapons, so he's not talking about incinerating.
Although his TV networks, you know,
they're really,
has got a huge airplay down in Britain, because they, there's a whole fascinating subject here about how the Russians, actually rather like the Iranians, they take the attitude that Britain is the real villain. And it goes back to the 19th century.
Boy, it sure does. Britain, the Great Game and all that.
The Great Game. Yeah. Britain is the real villain, and Uncle Sam is the sort of rich, naive sort of cat's paw for the British royal family, the Bank of England, and the other sinister conspirators who are really plotting to destroy Russia or whatever. And so
we are the Bond villains.
Yeah, right. And so their images, I mean, they show again and again images of nuclear weapons destroying Britain. I mean, so much so that they had a protest from the Irish foreign ministry, because those missiles also showed them blowing up Ireland.
Well, they had that classic British, the classic Bond villain thing, where they were going to detonate a nuclear missile in the north, in the Atlantic, and a tsunami would wash over both Britain and Ireland.
guys, is that all it would take was for someone like Vladimir Putin to use a nuclear weapon in an out of the way place in the middle of nowhere, blow up some factory out of, and the taboo would be broken. And I mean, I believe that there, you know, when we talk about needing a reminder, and we were talking about how long it's been since these weapons were used, there's this sense that, okay, well, no one would really use one. And I think something like that would, you know, I don't mean to put ideas into someone's head, but certainly the ideas are already there. Something like that would be a game changer, because it would literally be the way of saying, you think this could never happen. We're going to show you that we're serious. You know, it's funny, because after the Soviet Union fell, because you'd mentioned Abel Archer, but I mean, the last time we almost had a disaster was during the Boris Yeltsin era, where there was a mistake, right? Where somebody had misread radars or something. And you turn around and you go, okay, when I was, I don't know, a television news guy in my 20s, that's how we thought a nuclear war might happen, right? No one would obviously go and declare the Third World War. But these things, I mean, there's a great book called The Dead Hand, which is about the Soviet system that was in place in case their entire command and control structure were wiped out, it could still launch a retaliatory strike. And I think during the Yeltsin era, we thought, okay, the only way this is going to happen now is because of a mistake. And now we're back where we were 40 years ago, where you can actually envision someone like Putin saying, okay, I'm going to use a nuclear weapon in the middle of nowhere just to show everybody that they're out there, we can use them, and you're not safe from them.
But to be positive, just to be cheery for a bit.
that is not what
we're becoming a bit of a downer. I mean, he's hinted at that, and that this is clearly what he's brilliant at, is making people's flesh creep, and you know, menaces. It's, you know, kind of mafia type intimidation of shop owners or whatever. I mean, that's he's very.
Do you mean the British as shop owners? Is that what the nation of shopkeepers? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, he's kind of, you know, it would be awful if you did something and I had to, you know, something terrible in response without actually saying what the terrible thing
is. Nice country you have here. Be a shame if something happened to it. Yeah,
exactly. But actually, there have been a kind of number of dogs that haven't barked in the night. So obviously, the use of a tactical nuclear missile, battlefield nuclear missile, is one of them. But also, and I don't know whether this is because our cybersecurity is so good or because actually Russian cyber attacks aren't as good as we'd thought they were, but there haven't been kind of devastating attacks on Western cyber infrastructure. And you'd thought that perhaps there might be, you know, certainly at kind of defense institutions or whatever. And that is a kind of the raft of hope that I cling to.
Yeah. There's a reassuring element of shambles about the. But I guess you could say, though, Dan, that's actually not reassuring, because it's out of incompetence and chaos that mistakes are made and accidents happen.
Yes.
So I suppose you can see that two ways. You know, will a nuclear war start because a Dr. Evil thinks it's in their interests, or will it start because people are in a complete mess? They're frightened. Everything's falling apart around their ears. I mean, that's probably the more likely scenario, isn't it? Than a villain starting, you know, Bond villain starting a world war.
I think the implication of the fact that these kind of horror options haven't been taken up, I suspect must be because there are channels of communication that remain open between the Kremlin and the White House, between the Pentagon and the Russian military establishment, and it must have been intimated on both sides that there are red lines beyond which you shouldn't go.
But and you guys know
probably
better than
with sufficient
anyone. You know that sometimes dynamics get ahead of decision making. I mean, that's the whole First World War idea. That's the Cuban Missile Crisis. And which brings me back, not to change subjects radically, but we called the series that we did on the First World War Blueprint for Armageddon, because it was as Gwen Dyer, the military historian, had said, you know, the entrance into the idea of total war that makes the Second World War possible and the kinds of conversations we're having now possible. Can I shift and ask you guys another question similar to the one we did about the Romans and the Normans in 1066? But I want to ask you your views on First World War Germany versus Second World War Germany. And I had made the statement once that I thought, relative to the other powers involved, that the First World War German state was the stronger or more dangerous foe than the Second World War one. Now, in the United States, there's a fascination with the Second World War, the Nazi state. The technology is enticing and entrancing and all those kinds of things.
But it was my position that the First World War was the more stable society, the more deep society with the stronger foundation. Do you folks have any views on that? Maybe you differ from each other. I don't know.
I totally agree with you, Dan. So I'm a complete heretic on this because, as I think we discussed when you came on our podcast, I think Britain should have fought on the other side in the First World War.
Did you really?
Which is not a view you will often
No,
make.
No.
I'm a great fan of, you know, I like a Central European
coffee
house.
Those damn Belgians were asking for invasion.
Right, right. This was our chance, you know, to deal with the French once and for all, and we blew it. Anyway, listen, I agree with you. Wilhelmine Germany was in many ways, you know, an infinitely, as you say, deeper, more stable, more secure society than Nazi Germany. So, you know, if you think, I mean, Germany entering the 1910s, highly educated, very high level of political participation, very strong labor unions, for example. It's not obviously much less democratic than Britain or France, let's say. And I think it's, you know, it's in many ways remarkable, given the forces arrayed against it by the end of 1914, that Germany fights on as long and almost forces a draw, you know, could force a draw conceivably in 1917 or 1918. Nazi Germany, on the other hand, it's obviously led by somebody who is descending as the war continues foot deeper and deeper into paranoia. It's unstable. It doesn't have clear war aims. Everything is being improvised, you know, as they go along. It also has this distraction of its kind of anti-Semitic mission, which they feel more and more motivated to accomplish as the war goes on, and Hitler's sort of obsessive anti-Bolshevism as well, which obviously leads him to invade the Soviet Union. I mean, it's more dysfunctional, more hysterical kind of society. So I would say, yeah, the 1910s Germany is a much more formidable proposition. The Austria-Hungary is not the greatest ally in the world, but it's also got the Ottoman Empire, you know, which Britain makes a terrible mess of fighting at first at Gallipoli. So, yeah, and I think, you know, that the First World War could easily have ended in a draw, whereas there's a good argument, I would say, that Hitler was always going to lose the Second World War once he doesn't knock Britain out in 1940, and especially once he invades the Soviet Union and then declares war on the United States. A draw is unthinkable from that point onwards, I would say.
I completely agree that Wilhelmine Germany, economically, culturally, militarily, is formidably strong. I mean, it's probably, with the United States, a vision of the future if you're standing there in 1910. Britain already seems antiquated in comparison to both those countries. And Wilhelmine Germany with its, I mean, it's kind of universities. It's, you know, we've said at the beginning that technology and ability to innovate is fundamental to military prowess and power. And in that sense, Germany is absolutely cutting edge. However, I mean, obviously, the one thing to say about Nazi Germany is that ideas kill as well as tanks. And the ideas that the Nazis embody are lethally dangerous, way off the scale compared to any of the combatant powers in the First World War. And that has to be factored into, you know, I think any comparison of the two Germanies, that 6 million people were destroyed for ideological reasons by Nazi Germany. And that simply wouldn't have happened, even had the Kaiser won the First World War. Nothing comparable to that would have happened. I don't think that that being defeated by the Kaiser would have been a pleasant experience, but it was, you know, it was nothing comparable to being occupied by the Nazis.
Let me say that I think that plays a role into why the First World War state was stronger than the Second World War state. You go to the cemeteries from the First World War, the German cemeteries, and you will come across the graves of Jewish German patriots who fought for that regime. And you look at the, for example, nuclear scientists who defected from the Nazi German state and then helped the Allies. These are all people who conceivably,
in a less ideological, less anti-Semitic sort of society would have perhaps been fighting on the other side. It doesn't that by its very nature when you're taking people who are members of your population. And I mean, even at the end of the war, when the resources were so strained, they're still sending, you know, the train cars to the death camps, right?
Absolutely. And I agree with Dominic that basically the moment that Hitler fails to knock Britain out of the war, he's going to lose the war, I think. But suppose he had knocked Britain out of the war, suppose he'd occupied Britain, suppose he had established a kind of empire, a Reich over continental Europe and Britain. The impact of that would have been immeasurably more devastating than the Allies in the First World War being knocked out.
Do you even see that as possible? You see, when I look at it, and maybe I just lack imagination, I can't imagine that happening. I mean, Churchill talked about, you know, everybody, you could always take one with you and all that, but was a cross-channel invasion, and you guys know, I mean, a D-Day in reverse seems to have been...
Well, I don't think that there was ever any prospect of an invasion, but I do think there was a prospect of Britain suing for terms.
Yeah, I agree. That's
which
more
is
like,
why I think what is it? Is it 10 days in May? 9 days in May? I can never remember the John Lukács book.
Yeah,
brilliant analysis as the kind of the pivot of the 20th century. This period while Dunkirk is happening and France is in the process of surrendering, and there's a possibility that Churchill will be toppled and that the British government will open peace feelers to Italy and therefore by extension to Germany. And the very process of opening up peace feelers would have crippled Britain's ability to maintain morale, and that perhaps there you would, you know, Britain might not have been occupied, but it would have been a kind of Vichyist regime. And would the United States have become engaged then if it was a kind of continental Europe with this lethally anti-Semitic, racist regime that essentially was kind of trampling pretty much every ideal that the modern contemporary West holds sacred? I think that would have been possible.
I think the scenarios are interesting because let's imagine that the Kaiser's Germany either wins. I mean, it wins the First World War, I think, by Britain not becoming engaged in the war. So let's imagine the Kaiser's Germany wins the First World War. The Kaiser's Germany is then hegemonic in continental Europe in going into the 1920s. But it's a triumph. It's triumphalist. It's kind of strutting about. It's sort of preening, but there are still counterweights to it. I mean, Britain is still a counterweight, presumably. But also, it doesn't necessarily. I mean, the Kaiser's Germany at that point has achieved its aim. It has, you know, it has shored itself up against Tsarist Russia. It has put France very firmly in its box. Presumably, the Kaiser now has his place in the sun that he's always wanted. But I'm guessing the Kaiser's Germany doesn't have many more complicated war aims in the 1920s. Hitler's Germany, by contrast, is so unstable, is based on constant conflict and constant chaos. And so I don't see a Nazi new order. You know, that world of the kind of the man in the high castle, the Amazon drama where Nazi rule continues for decades. I don't really see that happening because I just think that sort of furious, I used the word hysterical before, that almost hysterical dynamism at the heart of the Nazi project would unravel.
I'm not sure.
Eventually.
Because I think that at the heart of Nazi ideology is the idea that the strong have the right to, I mean, not only the right, but they have a kind of moral responsibility to crush the weak. I mean, the Nazis do what they do, not because they want to be evil, but because they think they're doing what's right for their race. And if they've won a kind of victory, then that legitimates that perspective. And you know, it only has to last for, say, you know, a generation or two. And that then becomes part of the fabric of the way that people...
But Tom, you think people would copy them? You think people would... You think Nazism would become ingrained in the way that I know you think? Because Tom, I mean, I'm not going to make Tom's great argument for him, but Tom, one of Tom's great themes is how, even if we are not, you know, consciously Christians, everything we do is sort of permeated with kind of, as it were, Christian ideology. But you think that would have happened with Nazi ideology after one generation?
I think that part of the reason why the Nazis in the contemporary West serve as the embodiment of evil is that they did kind of target some of the key kind of ideological foundation stones of Christian Europe, of which obviously one is the idea that the strong owe a duty of care to the weak. The Nazis repudiated that. And the other is the idea that all human beings have an inherent dignity and that there is no Jew or Greek. And again, the Nazis repudiated that. The fact that they were defeated kind of has demonstrated, even if it's subliminally, the fact that those ideas are not just morally wrong, but are kind of, that they're unsustainable, that you can't organize a society on that basis. And that, I think, is very important to the way that the West understands not just its politics, but the very essence of human nature. But had the Nazis won, had they kind of enshrined that as, you know, their own victory as evidence that what they were saying was right, that their race, the Nordic race, was superior to other races, and that strength was more important than weakness, and that the powerful did have a responsibility to crush the powerless, and they could point to a prostrated Europe as evidence for this, and they were not overthrown, they were not humiliatingly defeated, they were not crushed, they were not obliged to surrender unconditionally, then those ideas would have had a currency in a way that they haven't in the as a result of what actually happened. A world in which fascism was not conclusively defeated would be one in which it continued to thrive, because it does play with the way that you know, lots of people do instinctively think. People do instinctively. People are instinctively chauvinist. People are instinctively inclined to think that the strong are more important and better than the weak. And it's only kind of, you know, centuries and centuries of Christian conditioning, really, in the context of Europe, that has changed that view. And if those values had been seen to be defeated, then I think that the corollary of that would reverberate through the decades.
So this is going to be a strange transition. So I'm going to try to transition it this way. One could make, certainly with the First World War Germans, one could make a case that there's a colonialism aspect involved, right? The place in the sun question is much more open. But even in the Second World War, strategic war aims of Germany, that's a colonialism too, in a sense, right? We're going to take over the Slavic lands, and we're going to rule over the Slavs, and they're going to be the slaves for the Nazi state. We had talked earlier about colonialism, and I'm curious about, you know, in the United States, we have certain figures in history. One is Tecumseh, for example, who tried to unite the native tribes against the United States at a certain point to try to figure out how you could fight back against the colonial powers and the colonial movements. I find that if you go into the history of, say, sub-Saharan Africa, North America, Central Asia, South Asia, you have all these attempts to try to fight back against the divide and conquer strategy that's so important in the colonial approach. I wanted to ask you guys if you had an opinion, which region would you consider the greatest odds-on favorite to resist colonial subjugation if they were ever able to unite in a Tecumseh-like way against the colonial powers?
So any region of the world that was ended up being absorbed into a European...
As part of the divide and conquer sort of strategy, yes.
No question, India. The British conquest of India was a kind of Anglo-Indian conquest. I mean, it wouldn't have been possible for the British to...
Right, because the numbers were
India
so small.
Company. Yeah, and you know, it's a private company taking over the whole subcontinent. I mean, you know, there's no way that they could possibly have done that unless India was completely fragmented and there were substantial segments of Indian society and different states within the framework of the whole subcontinent willing to work with the British and in a way to use the British just as the British were using them. So the Raj was, it was a kind of Anglo-Indian condominium. But I think that it was entirely possible in the 18th century for, you know, say in South India, the Sultanate of Hyderabad, of Mysore, Tipu Sultan in Mysore was, you know, I mean, he a heroic fighter against the British. Had Hyderabad, had Mysore, perhaps had they allied with the Marathas, there's no way the British could have conquered India. So I would, you know, and the moment that the sense of a united India came to be formed in the late 19th and 20th century, it became obvious to everyone that the Raj was going to end. I mean, even the most kind of dyed-in-the-wool imperialist had to accept the moment that there was a kind of Indian national consciousness emerging, there was no way that the British could hold on to India because the mismatch was too great.
I agree with Tom. But and I think that the reason India works, Tom, is because India had... There had been empires in India. So it's perfectly plausible to imagine that in the 18th, you know, had history worked out differently, that there would have been some dominant empire in India that would easily have been able to see off the East India Company. Do you not think? I mean, but that's not the case in other parts of the world. So if you, I mean, that thing of all the colonial, I would say almost every single colonial, European colonial empire works because it works with local collaborators and local allies. And that starts right at the beginning when the Spaniards arrive in the Valley of Mexico and then later on when they arrive in what's now Peru. So in both cases, the traditional view that we have is completely wrong. So the idea a tiny band of Spaniards pitch up and through their amazing technology and the fact that everybody thinks they're gods, they're able to overcome colossally superior numbers. I mean, that's just obviously nonsense. What happens is that in both cases, they're working with lots of local allies because the societies in which they've arrived are deeply fragmented and would always have been fragmented. So, you know, the what we think of as the Aztecs, they have lots of local rivals. I think Tlaxcala are the most obvious ones that the Spaniards ally with. And the Spaniards are only able to defeat them because of their local allies. Same thing with the Incas. The Spaniards arrived, the Incas are divided, but they were probably always going to be divided because they had a history of division and there were lots of people who resented the Incas. So that's slightly different from India, because I think in India you'd had, hadn't you, Tom, kind of big, powerful, rich, united civilizations that could easily have seen off European intruders. And I don't think that's true in the Americas. You know, it's impossible to imagine, I think, the Native Americans of North America forming this massive confederation that would have seen off the French and the British. I mean, they had no history of such alliances.
No, but here's what's funny. They imitated exactly what you were talking about, right? They did it in reverse. So someone like Tecumseh, for example, tried to use the British to help him defeat the Americans, in the same way that before there was a United States, certain tribes allied with the French or the British to try to see the other side. In other words, that's almost the reverse of what you're talking about, right?
But by that point, it's too late, isn't it?
It is too late.
But also, I think technology does matter, and scale of size matters as well. But to go back to the technology, I mean, Dan, you were saying, you know, why were people, I don't know, beyond the frontiers of the Roman Empire, not able to replicate the legions because they didn't have the society, the culture that had generated the legions. And likewise, if you're going through a kind of an industrial quantum leap, if you're going through the Industrial Revolution, if you are developing weapons that are fearsome and devastating on a scale beyond the imaginings of people who don't have factories, who don't have steel mills. And if you are a civilization that is able to feed vast numbers of people and generate a huge population growth, then there's no way you can resist it. And that essentially, you know, going right the way back through the entire span of time, that's why we all now have urban civilizations and we're not hunter-gatherers, is because ultimately, there are technological, there are societal advances that will make certain societies stronger, more powerful, more devastating, more lethal than others. And when there is a total mismatch, those who are the weaker will be, there's no way that they can withstand. So I would say that I'm sure that the Aztecs could have seen off the Spaniards, but I don't think that there was ever any prospect that the Native Americans of the Great Plains could have seen off the United States. I don't think that there was ever any prospect of the Native people in Australia seeing off the settlers in the 19th and 20th century. There was just no way it would ever have been possible.
Okay, so I'll make this the last question, but it's certainly a trapdoor kind of question because it may. So one of the things you get here in the United States, and I think you get them all over the world, is this idea of that these technologically superior or I don't know what you would call it, a logistically, infrastructurally superior entities should not have done what they did, right? So for example, the people who came from Europe should not have done what they did in a broad sense. We're not talking about individual massacres or this, but in a broad sense, should not have done what they did. I find it in an almost I find it impossible to imagine the counterfactual in these situations when you have societies that are so dominating in terms of technological or as we said, logistical or infrastructural advantages. It's hard for me to imagine, for example, the Europeans finding the new world and then just saying, well, you know, we're just going to sit aside and not do anything. Ooh. I mean, in other words,
let them have their gold. Let them keep their gold.
The continent.
Yeah. Yes, this wonderful open land. John Wayne once said it was okay for the Europeans to take the land from the natives because they weren't properly using it. I mean, is it one of those things where are we assuming something that almost would be a defying human nature to expect something like that to happen?
Well.
Okay. A trapdoor question emerges.
Tom, before you go, can I just...
You know what I'm going to say.
I know you're going to say it, and Tom will take a week to say it, so I'll...
That's okay. We have it. We have it.
Well, it's your podcast, Dan. I mean, the podcast
right. We have no time limits,
anyway.
Obviously, if you've ever heard me.
So I would say, whenever people tell this story, and they... Now, Tom also knows what I'm going to say, and is probably rolling his eyes. I think whenever people tell this story, and they start sort of, you know... As it were, I don't want to sound like I'm a lunatic, so but I will. When they start sort of wringing their hands and saying this is dreadful behavior, this is very awful, we should feel very sorry about it, all this sort of stuff, I just think that's ahistorical. I think people behave in inverted commas badly throughout history all the time.
Reliably.
Big, rich, technologically adept, aggressive societies will behave aggressively. I think it's impossible. I think it's literally impossible to imagine a scenario in which Columbus sails west and then the Spanish don't do what they do in Mexico and Peru, for example. I mean, they don't all behave badly because they're all villains. They behave badly, I would say, because they're human and because that's what people do. So I think the sort of expressions of slight shock that we have now as 21st century spectators looking at all this, which is sort of, oh, how could the Spanish do what they did? How could the British behave so meanly in India and Africa and all of this kind of stuff? We should feel very sorry and kind of rend our garments and weep and wail about it. I mean, again, I know some of your listeners will probably think I'm being too flippant, but I think the story of history is that this is part of being human. I mean, as awful as that may seem to many of us, and I know Tom will talk about why that seems awful to us and the sort of ideological sort of coaching we've had to think that. And of course, we all have that because we want to think of ourselves as nice people. But yeah, I completely agree with you, Dan. I think it's impossible to imagine a scenario in which Europeans can travel vast distances in great numbers with... you know, with weapons, with firearms, with all of their diseases as well, by the way, and in which they don't subjugate these places. And I don't think it's because there's something intrinsically wicked about early modern Europeans. I think it's because, to be brutal about it, that kind of competitive, acquisitive, exploitative strain is deep inside human nature. And it's an interesting aspect of being a 21st century Westerner that we shudder at that and we recoil from it, even as I think deep down we can see it in ourselves.
So Dan, what I would say to that is, you know, was it bad? What is the definition of bad? What's the definition of good? What is wrong with going and conquering other people? What is wrong with, if you're much more powerful, subjugating those who are weaker than you? And they may sound kind of shocking questions, but they're only shocking because we take the answer to those questions pretty much for granted. But if you look at the vast sweep of history, it's not at all self-evident that people regard, particularly in powerful and self-confident and aggressive civilizations, that they regard conquering people who are weaker than them as something that is, quote unquote, wrong. So going right the way back to the beginning, if you look at the Nama palette, which is kind of one of the foundational emblems of ancient Egypt, it shows the figure of a pharaoh combating the forces of chaos, and the images of people on that frieze who are not Egyptian, who lie beyond the borders of Egypt, makes it clear that they are the people who are the object of the pharaoh's wrath and might, and that their subjugation is the right thing to do, that this is a moral positive, that this is the correct thing to do. And it's very difficult to think of an empire in antiquity that did not see its conquests as in some way the expression of what either the gods wanted or kind of moral abstractions being worked out. So whether it's the Assyrians or the Babylonians or indeed even the Israelites, their conquests are mandated by the divine. Same with the Persians, but the Persians introduced this incredibly novel idea that the world is moral and that their empire is the expression of kind of an abstract force of truth and order that permeates itself throughout the entire fabric of the universe. And that's an inheritance that that Christians and Muslims have inherited. So the caliphate, the Arab conquests, they are justified. But this is what God wants. God wants the world to become Muslim. I think what makes the thing that is slightly more complex is the Christian attitude to this, because on the one hand, Christianity is a missionary religion that, like Islam, sees itself as a gift given to the whole of humanity. And therefore, Christians, like Muslims, have a duty to spread their faith to the ends of the world. But what makes Christianity more ambivalent in its attitude to this kind of imperialism is the fact that Christ himself dies the victim of a great empire, namely the Romans. And of course, the cross is an emblem of the right of the powerful to torture to death the powerless. And this becomes the emblem of Christianity. It's the emblem that the Spaniards, for instance, take to the New World. So when the Spaniards conquer Mexico, of course, there is a sense of triumph. They are the conquistadores. The idea that God has given them this world and that it redounds to the glory of Spain, that it's something to celebrate. Of course, that is an element of it. But there is also a nagging sense that perhaps what they're doing is offensive to God. And it's really summed up with the kind of the great debate between two Spanish theologians, one of whom, Bartolomé Las Casas, argues that the Indians have souls and that what the Spaniards are doing essentially is not justified by God's law. And his opponents, when they argue against this, have to draw on classical tradition to say, you know, certain people are natural slaves. Of course, they should be conquered. And I think that ambivalence towards empire, so, you know, if you're going out under the emblem of a cross, are you playing the Romans or are you playing the guy who gets tortured to death by the Romans? I think that is an ambivalence that has lain at the heart of the kind of the Western conquest of the world, the hegemony that the West has exercised over the world. And in a way, the fact that people beyond the West have bought into this, the fact that they too kind of buy into the idea that there is a kind of dignity in being oppressed, that victimhood brings its own status. The paradox is that in a way that is an expression of continuing Western hegemony. I mean, there's nothing really kind of more Western than the idea of decolonization, for instance. If you're decolonizing something, you are expressing deeply, deeply Western ideas. But it's a kind of massive, it's a kind of moral Möbius strip. Are these ideas inherently correct, or are they, do we think that they're correct because we've all of us been weathered by the effects of empires that believed that and were kind of the vectors for it?
There's a split the difference, though. There's a split the difference in this. I mean, if you, like, when I was when you go read the primary source materials,
from an era where people absolutely believed that there is eternal damnation and eternal hellfire if you're not saved by a religion. If you believe that your conquest of, say, a native peoples who are pagan or heathen or whatever word you would use, and because you have shown them the way, that you have saved them from an eternity in hellfire, then whatever you did to them in this one life is, by comparison, meaningless. In other words, how do good people justify this? I think that's how good people tell themselves that they've done a good deed by conquering and enslaving other people, as long as you save them from an eternal damnation. Does that make sense?
But what is good? But what is good? I mean, that's the thing. What's the definition of good? Because your definition of goodness is constantly changing.
Oh, sure. Oh, right. Sure.
I mean, so I think, you know, the Aztecs, they were themselves imperialists. Their extraordinary city, their extraordinary civilization was itself founded on conquest. And as far as I know, there was no one in Aztec society that questioned that. There wasn't the kind of questioning of the right of the powerful to conquer the powerless that, say, the Spaniards brought, even though the paradox is that the Spaniards were infinitely more lethal and destructive.
I mean, I would say, Dan, I mean, I don't know whether Tom agrees with this. I just think asking the question, bad or good, is the wrong question to ask about history.
Well, unless you're a theologian.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, some of your listeners may well be thinking, well, what do you expect? You know, you get two British guys on and they're kind
of That's right.
Excuses for colonialism. But I mean, one way, if they think that, is to ask this. So some of the most effective conquests in history were the Arab conquests.
Yes.
And you know, here's a question. Were the Arabs wrong to conquer Egypt? Was that bad? I mean, if you went to Cairo today and you proposed that argument and you said this was a terrible thing, it was exploitative, it was aggressive, it was unprovoked, it shouldn't have happened, the people who did it were bad and they were villainous, and sure, they did it, they claimed they were doing it for religious reasons, but no doubt there was a lot of greed and cruelty and all this sort of stuff. I mean, if you made that argument in the center of Cairo, people would think you were demented. I mean, and I don't think, and most people, I think, would feel very uneasy making such an argument about the Arab conquests, because we tend to make those arguments about good and bad actually with relation to Western colonialism, don't we? And we think of colonialism as a purely Western phenomenon, as a European phenomenon. But I mean, imagine making that argument about the Ottoman Empire and saying the Ottomans were wrong to have conquered Constantinople. They were wrong to have taken Bosnia.
The Greeks certainly make that argument.
Well, the Greeks would make that argument, but then would you say the Greeks were wrong to have landed in Sicily and to have established their colony at Syracuse or something? I mean, that would seem
crazy argument to make. You know my answer to that. I mean, good, you know, right and wrong, good and evil are cultural constructs.
Of course they are.
Generally,
I agree with you.
Generally are propagated by the powerful. And, yeah, you know, the ideas of good and evil or right or wrong or justified invasion or whatever are generally created to sustain structures that have been created by the powerful. Because if they're not powerful, then they don't last.
Well, I mean, in the United States, you could say if we have a problem with the invasion of the Spaniards into the New World, for example, and they come in. I mean, the Comanches had a genocidal war against the Plains Apaches. But that is beyond the pale of the sort of ethical discussions we have about this sort of stuff, because these are indigenous peoples against other indigenous peoples. In other words, it's like Gallic tribes fighting other Gallic tribes and then Caesar comes in. Is there any difference between having an outsider?
But surely your argument here is who are outside. I mean, how far are you allowed to travel to fight? Surely that's it.
No,
because let's
take
the example of the Aztecs. The Aztecs were not indigenous to the Valley of Mexico. They had moved south. So is it okay for them to move by land, but not okay for the Spaniards to move by sea? I mean, I think the trouble is these are, when you start to look into these, those sort of moral boundaries, I think, just begin to crumble. I mean, I don't think you can say it's fine for the Aztecs to come to trudge overland and then start fighting people, but because the Spaniards have come by ship and have paler skins, that's not okay.
Well, so unless you're a theologian, as a historian, I think you have to regard morality as relative, as culturally conditioned, as something that evolves and changes. In other words, not as something absolute. Because if you're treating it as something absolute, then you're engaging in a slightly different discipline, I think. Which isn't to say that discipline is wrong. I mean, that's what theology and philosophy and ethics is all about. But if you're looking at history, to talk about ideas of right and wrong as absolutes, you have to recognize that the sense of these as absolutes is culturally conditioned. So to look at the Gauls, was it wrong for the Romans to conquer the Gauls? I mean, to the Romans, no, and probably not to the Gauls either, because the Gauls had sacked Rome. The Gauls were constantly rampaging around. They were tribes. They were endlessly attacking each other. The Romans conquered them, and the Gauls ended up kind of acknowledging the Romans as the most powerful tribe of all. And that was kind of part of the moral universe that both Romans and Gauls in the first century BC inhabited. If we look now, say the question you asked, can white Americans sit in judgment and say that, say, the Comanches were wrong to attack other Native American peoples in the Great Plains? Inherent in that is the idea that because Native Americans ended up being conquered and subdued and subordinated to the power of the white settlers, therefore they have a status as victims that white settler society privileges, because that white settler society brings with it the idea that its God suffered the death of a slave at the hands of an imperial power. And even if people, you know, particularly on the liberal wing and progressive wing in the United States, are no longer overtly Christian, they're not denominationally Christian, morally, in their hearts, they remain Christian, and they retain the conviction that there is a status and a moral value in being a victim, that being a victimizer, being an imperial power, does not possess. And that therefore, people who come from a position of privilege are not entitled to sit in judgment over those who are not privileged. But that is a culturally conditioned assumption that is bred of the distinctive character of American history, I would argue. I mean, you could go further and say, well, that is an absolute moral position. But if you're doing that, you're no longer engaging in history, in my opinion. You're engaging in philosophy or theology.
And for more on this, Tom Holland's book, Dominion, would
Oh, thank you, Dan. Thank you very much. That's very sweet.
Gentlemen, I could continue this all day, but it's about 115 degrees in my studio right now, and I am melting. Where can people hear your podcast?
So it's called The Rest is History. You can hear it on Spotify, you can hear it on iTunes, and you can hear it on YouTube. And we do two episodes every week, don't we, Tom?
Sometimes a few more.
Covering everything. They're much, I have to say, compared with Dan's, your opuses. I mean, these are mere pamphlets. Some of them are only 45 or 50 minutes.
That is a great way to rationalize my lack of productivity. Thank you. I appreciate that.
We do two a week, and we have a club called the Rest is History Club. And if you join the club, you can have chats with all the other club members, and they'll get very excited, don't they, Tom? They basically spend most of their time telling us how terrible our most recent episode was, or whatever. So it's the Rest is History. It's not as hardcore as hardcore history, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, Tom?
I think it's less epic and sweet, but we are kind of inspired by you, Dan. We're upping our game. So we've just done a 5-part special on the American Civil War, and you may be appalled at the idea that we could possibly do the American Civil War in 5 episodes. but when we tell you that we did the whole French Revolution in I think about an hour,
oh my gosh, okay,
you'll see that we're doing better.
Okay, well, yeah. You guys are delightful. I'd love to have another conversation with you someday. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
My thanks to Tom Holland and Dominic Sandbrook for coming on the program today. Their podcast, The Rest is History, is something you should absolutely check out if you haven't already. It's been a long, hot summer full of challenges in the family stuff and everything else. So it's been a while since we've spoken to you. Thank you for your patience. I know many of you have had similar summers, but I feel back in the saddle again, so we should have some offerings on tap for you before too long. And, if I don't talk to you until then, well, remember, we have a Twitter feed @HardcoreHistory. Maybe you can hear from me in the interim And I hope you're all having a good summer and a good year. And here's to hoping that things pick up and get better, you know, as the end of the year rolls around. It's difficult times for a lot of people, isn't it? And we hope you'll stay safe. Talk to you soon, folks.
Support us with Patreon by going to patreon.com/DanCarlin or go to our donate page at dancarlin.com/DC-donate.
For hardcore history t-shirts or other merchandise, go to dancarlin.com.